the Legal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Ninety minutes to go. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, Ezra Ginsberg with you. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend, Arthur Staple. Arthur covers the New York Islanders for Newsday newspaper. Arthur, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be back with you guys.
Our pleasure to have you back, Arthur. Obviously, we brought you on to talk. We'll start with the Casey Cizikas contract signing. It's a five-year term. He gets paid a salary cap hit of about $3.35 million per season. What surprised you more, if anything, the length of the contract or the term per year for that Cizikas got from GM Garth Snow?
You know, I think the number was probably a little bit high for most people, and by some of the initial reactions, I think people were a little surprised given the ice time that he has, and obviously he's part of that fourth line that does a lot for the Islanders. But I think if you dig a little deeper to see, he was arbitration eligible with two more years of restricted free agency. He was probably going to get somewhere around $3 million if he went to arbitration just for the short term. They bought back 3 years of unrestricted free agency, and I think maybe the biggest surprise is just how much the Islanders like what Casey Cizikas brings. He's a face-off guy. He's part of one of a key penalty killer for their top five penalty kill from this past season, and he scored some big goals, 30 points. You know, I believe he was third or fourth on the team in even strength points per game. So, he brings a lot, and maybe it's not something that a lot of people outside don't see the Islanders see. But considering how much their forward group is in this summer, it was probably essential to them to lock him up long term.
Arthur, Casey Cizikas has really been locked in there as the fourth line center with Cal Clutterbuck and Matt Martin on his wings. Now that he's being paid a little bit more money, how are those expectations for him going to change? Are they going to expect him to be a third line center now? Are they going to expect him to take on more of a leadership role? How does that change now that he was given a five-year contract?
You know, I think there were a lot of nights where that fourth line was really the third line. They played a lot, and certainly down the stretch and into the first round of the playoffs, for sure, where they were a little bit slow getting out of the gate against Florida, but really started to become very effective toward the end of that series and into the Tampa series, certainly at the beginning. They were a line that really was the only line that stayed together all year and at times got a lot more minutes than some of the middle six forwards. His role is pretty well defined. I think it's going to change just because the makeup of that forward group is going to change. We still don't know if Franz Nielsen is going to be back, who's kind of the designated second or third line center. So without Nielsen there, Brock Nelson is a guy who's kind of gone back and forth from wing to center. And, depending on what the Islanders want to do this month in terms of trying to trade to upgrade, Brock Nelson could be someone who gets moved. You never know. Ryan Strome is a similar guy who plays a couple different positions. So I think they know what they have in Cizikas. He's a center. He's an effective guy. He hits. He does those things that coaches love that maybe the metrics guys do not love. But I think even possession-wise, that line was much better than it's been in previous years. And I think with Matt Martin probably on the way out the door, Cizikas and Clutterbuck could team with someone like a Shane Prince and have that line kind of suddenly it changes a little bit. They add a little more speed, a little bit more offensive firepower in addition to the physical side. So I think with the idea that that Cizikas was certainly going to be there long term, and Matt Martin is probably not going to be back, maybe that line sort of changes what it's set out to do and how it's deployed.
You know, Arthur, you talk about Matt Martin. Are his demands going to be maybe similar to Cizikas' contract demands? I realize that one's a UFA and one was an RFA, but are his demands going to be similar? And if so, are the Islanders resigned to the fact that you can't afford to pay your fourth line combined that much money?
I just think it's more of a role. You know, Matt Martin is without equal, really, in terms of his popularity with on the Islanders and how he's built up being really kind of the community leader on this team. He loves living on Long Island. He usually stays here year round, which is pretty rare. He has a pretty famous girlfriend whose father is a New York Long Island legend and Boomer Esiason. So, you know, he's really embraced being part of this community, and I think it's been a difficult transition for him to kind of understand that this is his big chance. You know, kind of like Derek Dorsett a few years ago, Brandon Prust, mm-hmm. guys who fill that role don't get a chance to hit the jackpot like Matt Martin can in free agency. And I don't think it's really a situation where both sides want to end their relationship and say it's time to move on. I'm sure the Islanders would love to have him back. I'm sure he'd love to be back. But I think his camp and the Islanders realize the situation that they're in, and that, you know, like you said, you can't pay, you know, the hits leader and a guy who only plays at even strength $3 million a year when you've got so much other... Right. So many other pieces in play and so many other things to resolve going forward, that, you know, not just this summer, but in summers to come. So, you know, I think that that writing has been on the wall for a little while, and Matt Martin is a true professional and a guy that accepts the reality of the situation. And I think he's going to get a very good offer, probably a couple of very good offers, and maybe that 5-day window of contact with other GMs will change his mind, and he'll want to come back and take more of a discounted offer. You know, I would guess that something around $2 million per year for 3 or 4 years would be the sort of deal the Islanders could live with. But I think he's going to go well north of that and probably have a couple of teams to choose from, just because I think from the outside, teams see what he brings and see the attitude that he has and would love to add that to their room.
Arthur Staple is our guest here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Arthur covers the New York Islanders for Newsday newspaper. Arthur, we've talked about Casey Cizikas. We've talked about Matt Martin, the two other big UFAs this offseason, Kyle Okposo and Franz Nielsen. If you were if you could put a percentage, let's say, on each of them, what percentage would you give Okposo re-signing in New York on Long Island, and what percentage would you give Nielsen to re-sign on Long Island?
Well, these are going to be big spreads of numbers. I would say, you know, I've kind of stuck with the 70% for Franz Nielsen pretty much since the middle of the year. And I'll stick with that for now. You know, I think there's been very initial talks between his agent and Garth Snow since the season ended. So, you know, I think it's a situation where he's a guy who not only wants to stay, but I don't think is, you know, at 32 is looking to break anyone's bank. You know, just knowing him a little bit, and you can never know when money gets involved, but he's been very loyal. He talks often about the opportunity that he got to you know, to come over from Europe and be an integral part of this team. He's the longest serving member of this team, over 600 games, and the Islanders really appreciate what he brings. We always talk about Nielsen being underrated. I think we can throw that word out the window. I think everybody around the league knows what he can bring, and you know, just he's a guy who plays shorthanded. He plays power play, key faceoffs, deployed against the other team's top lines. Usually, you know, and he does it all with a pretty upbeat attitude about it all, and just how badly he wants to win and wanted to see this team kind of break through, even to the point where they're at now after so many years of losing. So, you know, I still feel like there's a deal to be made there, and I'll put the number for Okposo at 5% right now. You know, I would say zero, but you can never say never. It just seems like since before the season started, you know, last summer when there was very preliminary talks between his camp and Garth Snow, I think those quickly resulted in Snow shopping him around to see what he could get for him going into his walk year. I think that was the writing on the wall. There really hasn't been much conversation since then, and I think the Islanders have an idea of what Kyle Okposo is worth to them, and, you know, a guy who's as young as he is hitting unrestricted free agency with some of the numbers he's had and the, you know, shaking off some serious injuries over the last few years, to still be a successful player and a pretty high point per game average player around the league. He's going to get a lot of offers to choose from with this pretty thin free agent class, and I think the Islanders are willing to let him go and try to go in a different direction in terms of finding a top-line wing.
Arthur, because it seems highly likely that the Islanders are going to lose Kyle Okposo and Matt Martin, do you expect the Islanders to be active not only in free agency but in and around the NHL draft. And we know that Garth Snow and the Islanders aren't afraid to be active at the draft.
Yeah, he does. He does pull some rabbits out of the hat there at the on the draft floor. You know, they nearly got Corey Schneider a few years ago when they were shopping Nino Niederreiter around, and obviously, you know, a lot of people in Edmonton might be ruining the deal on the draft floor last June, where they gave up Griffin Reinhart to a chance to select Matthew Barzal. So he knows what he's doing in terms of the trade front, and I personally think that's the area where they're going to be most active. I know there's lots of teams that are looking to unload players and wondering about what the expansion draft is going to look like, either whether it's next year or 2 years from now. But I think I think Garth Snow is leaning a lot more towards reshaping this roster, especially among the forwards, through trades and trying to get guys that are under control, younger, contract demands don't necessarily enter into it. I think they feel like with so few good forwards out there in unrestricted free agency, the numbers are going to go crazy very quickly. And I think they want to be able to manage their cap situation and their finances and their, you know, the prospects for the expansion draft going forward in a little bit better way. So they do have some younger prospects, guys like Michael Dalcol, Joshua Hosang, to throw into deals. They've got the 19th pick, which I would imagine is probably in play for them to try to find someone to fit into that top six to be a guy who, you know, find maybe a wing who can be John Tavares's permanent line mate going forward. They certainly tried tons of different people there this year, and Tavares still had a pretty successful season. But I think they realize they need a big gun to go alongside Tavares for the long term, and that's probably what they're looking for the most.
You look at their back end, Arthur, and to me, you know, the right side seems to be taking shape, especially with Ryan Pulock and the expectations for him behind, you know, Boychuk and Hamonic now, as you reported, wanting to stay on Long Island and in Brooklyn. Do you see the team addressing, kind of, to me, that left side after Nick Leddy?
I think they like what Calvin DeHaan brings. I could certainly see them, if need be, shopping him around. He's got one more year on his deal before, and still a restricted free agent. But I think he took some pretty big strides this past season to be a reliable guy. And you know, they've got Thomas Hickey there, who might arguably have been their best defenseman in the playoffs. He was really active. He seemed to really thrive in those pressure situations. Had the big overtime winner against the Panthers in Game 3 that helped turn the series in their favor. And I think he really showed in that playoffs the promise that he showed, as an amateur when he was the fourth overall pick by the Kings back, almost a decade ago. So I think they feel like they're pretty happy with where things are there. And even Adam Pelech, who, had a few games before he ended up leaving, missing the rest of the season with the same thoracic outlet syndrome that Steven Stamkos had. Mm-hmm. But they feel like he's back healthy and he's still young, 22 years old, another left-handed shooting guy. So I think they feel like they go, seven deep right now, eight deep. They've got Scott Mayfield, who's another, homegrown prospect who's, a big guy who can fill that 7-8 role. So I think they're focusing more on forwards and trying to solve the complex situation they have in goal right now. But with Hamonic deciding to stay, that really, I think, was not only big for the team and for, to have a guy like him staying in the fold, but just to sort of, be a bit of a sigh of relief to not have to solve that problem as well.
Arthur Staple covers the New York Islanders for Newsday newspaper. Arthur, we'll let you go on this last question. Thomas Greiss obviously had an impressive performance down the stretch and in the playoffs. Yaroslav Halak reportedly needs surgery if he hasn't already had it. The Islanders are comfortable with a Halak and Greiss combination going forward into next season?
I think they may have to be. I'm sure that if Yaro Halak were healthy going into this offseason, there would be consideration to try to move him just to get his salary off the books and clear the way for, something a little bit more traditional in terms of having a goaltending tandem. They've also got JF Berube, who they picked up off waivers from the Kings, who's a restricted free agent who they like a lot, and who basically sat around until Halak got hurt as a guy they didn't want to put back on waivers because they knew he would get claimed. It's an interesting situation. Do they feel that Greiss is the guy going forward? He certainly was capable enough for the bulk of the regular season, and certainly through that Florida series, he was by far the better goalie in that series. But I think there's still some concerns about whether he could be a number one. There's obviously lots of health concerns about Halak, who did have surgery 2 weeks ago, and you know, going into a very uncertain offseason where he hasn't played in many months. I could even see them sniffing around some of the goalies that that'll be shopped, whether it's Jimmy Howard, although I feel like he maybe has a little too much term left. Ben Bishop, who Jack Capuano, another Maine alum, is a big fan of. If he's the odd man out in Tampa, maybe there's a way to make a deal there to get him for his last year of his contract and kind of settle things. But I just think there's a lot of things in play in terms of a net and up front for them. And this feels like it's going to be a very busy month, or at least they're going to try to make it a busy month before we get to unrestricted free agency and the money starts to get a little crazy.
They're gonna keep you busy and they're gonna put you to work. So we'll look forward to reading all about the New York Islanders. Arthur Staple of Newsday newspaper. Arthur, really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Anytime.
We'll talk soon. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Carolina Hurricanes, Peter Karmanos, and maybe we'll even try and get Craig Button on the line. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
One of you people, I don't know who it is, I'll find out, they start to suggest that maybe we're moving the team. We can't move the team. We've got one of the best leases for one of the best buildings in the entire league. And I think one of the best markets is back to being the first or second fastest growing market in the country.
That clip, which I believe was from last year, was Carolina Hurricanes owner Peter Karmanos talking about relocation rumors, talking about the future of the Carolina Hurricanes in Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, DJ DeMare is in town, his final night, his final two shows. Check him out, get tickets, rumorscomedyclub.com. So that was Karmanos from last year, Richard, pouring cold water on the possibility that the Hurricanes would be leaving the Golden Triangle, as they like to say, leaving the Raleigh, North Carolina area. It seems as though the Carolina Hurricanes and Karmanos personally are running into some financial difficulties. Reports that he had loaned $100 million from a trust that he established for his three adult sons, wasn't able to pay back the trust in time, and now his sons are suing him in court for that $100 million. That's, of course, very sad when a family dispute like that becomes public. Apparently, this has been a long time coming, as none of his children showed up at his Hockey Hall of Fame induction ceremony in Toronto last fall. And his son, Jason Karmanos, who worked for the Hurricanes, was fired 4 days before training camp back in 2013. So take away the family dispute, because obviously we don't know the intricacies of that, and we don't want to speculate about that. But how concerned would you be as a hockey fan in Raleigh, North Carolina? How concerned should the NHL be about the future of the Carolina Hurricanes? It's been reported that Karmanos has been looking for an investor in the team for a number of years now with no luck at all. And shouldn't this just automatically pour cold water on the possibility of expansion to Las Vegas, even though we all think that's going to go ahead?
Right. As you mentioned, the Carolina Hurricanes have probably been for sale for at least 2 years, maybe 3 years. As you mentioned, whether it's a minority owner, even though you hear now that Peter Karmanos wants to have a majority owner come in, but he still really wants to call all of the shots. And that doesn't really sound appealing if you're going to buy an NHL team, right, but not have the ultimate say, right? So I don't know how concerned the NHL is, Drew, and I don't know if Carolina is going to relocate to whether it's Quebec or Seattle, but I can tell you one thing. It's very unfortunate that the Carolina Hurricanes ownership situation has got to this point with Peter Karmanos owing his own son's money. And you remember he let his son go a couple of years back. Mm-hmm. His son used to be involved with the Carolina Hurricanes. Because when you look at the Hurricanes, and this was a transition year for the Carolina Hurricanes, they actually did a lot better, Richie, than I think most people thought they would do, myself included. But you look at some of the young talent that's coming through there, Noah Hanifin, Justin Falk has become a top defenseman for them. Hayden Fleury's a guy that's going to come along. They're going to have another high draft pick, another top 10 draft pick this year. It's really unfortunate that the Carolina Hurricanes haven't been able to resolve this and bring someone in. And Peter Karmanos, from what I've heard, is not the easiest guy to deal with, and he can be a stubborn guy. But this team needs desperately this to get resolved, and it's possible that it's a very realistic possibility that this team relocates. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen quickly in the next year or two, but it's a possibility. I mean, you have this ownership situation reminds you a bit of Atlanta, doesn't it?
You can certainly make the comparisons. It's not at that dire straits just yet, but you can certainly see that.
I don't know, when you're talking about $100 million lawsuits, Drew, that's pretty serious.
That is certainly pretty serious. I mean, what you have in the difference is in Atlanta, you had nobody that really wanted to own that team, even when they still actively owned that team. Karmanos, you know, I think in an ideal world would be glad to still own this team, be glad to have revenue generating, be glad to, you know, he's been a hockey guy through and through since, I mean, he owned the Hartford Whalers. His CompuWare Junior program is huge in Michigan. Him and Mike Ilitch, the Detroit Red Wings owners, they hate each other because they've been fierce combatants over junior hockey in Michigan for years now. So this isn't a case of a guy who bought a team and then decided he doesn't like hockey. This is a case of a guy who loves hockey, but seems to be running into financial difficulties. My guess is related to the hockey business and probably related to his computer business, his CompuWare business as well. So I think that's a little bit why it differs from Atlanta, but you know, two Sun Belt teams, no real hockey lineage, no real hockey history, despite the cup win for the Hurricanes. If you're the NHL and you're Gary Bettman, I think you have to be concerned.
Yeah, Drew, I think you would be concerned. And as you mentioned, it's kind of some of their talent. And sure, I mean, they have a good young defense core. You mentioned the draft picks that they have coming through. I think brighter times are ahead. But the question is, are they going to be able to keep the team afloat before they, you know, become a contender again and probably change their financial situation?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously lawsuits and things like that provide a distraction and a financial cost to that as well. Even if you are successful, the cost of having to deal with that. So, I don't know enough about it. I just know that this team has, you know, there has seemed to be a lot of turmoil around the team for a little while now, and he's looked for investors in the past. And I don't believe wanting to dispose of more than a majority, to give up his majority stake in the team, which is a factor for prospective purchaser.
Mm-hmm.
They'd probably want to be the majority owner. So that would be a factor as well. So yeah, it doesn't seem like it's the best situation right now. And you do wonder if the expansion announcement coming, if there maybe will be one less team just in case there is a significant issue that arises that requires them to, to take a serious look at relocation.
Richie, yeah. I should mention actually, Andrew, that Carolina actually has the 13th overall pick. So they don't have a top 10 pick, but point being, that they have
talent and they're going to get another talent.
They have a lot of good young prospects, especially on defense, which has been the Achilles heel of this team. And the future of Cam Ward is uncertain.
Eric Staal's gone, of course.
Eric Staal is gone, and you know there's a chance that the Carolina Hurricanes go after a big name free agent. I wouldn't expect them to get a Steven Stamkos, but they are going to have to go after someone with the loss of a guy like Eric Staal. But this team has had attendance issues for many years now. I think the Carolina Hurricanes organization and fans are great, but there's a distinct possibility that this team relocates just based on the fact that they've had trouble getting an owner. Peter Karmanos has all types of legal issues going on here, and I think the people of Quebec City especially are really looking at this situation with a keen eye because of what's at stake here. Because it looks like Vegas is going to get the first expansion team, and Quebec City might be a better target for relocation. And Gary Bettman and Bill Daly are never going to say that that this is the case. They'll always say that they're not in the business of relocating franchises. But a lot of people didn't think Atlanta was going to relocate, and we know what happened. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. I don't wish that, by the way.
No.
I hope that it doesn't get to that point. I hope that the ownership situation is resolved and they stay there, because Carolina, especially winning the Cup in 2006, you know, they've done a great job there kind of creating a fan base. But certainly the way it's looking now, it's not good.
When we come back, we head out to San Jose and speak with Canadian Press hockey reporter Jonas Siegel about tonight's Game 3 between the Sharks and the Penguins. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Hour number 3 here of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg with you here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We head out to the Bay Area, where Jonas Siegel, national hockey writer for the Canadian Press, is covering the Penguins and the Sharks. Jonas, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, guys.
Obviously, Jonas, Game 3 goes tonight, the Penguins with a 2-0 lead. You know, the couple days off in between Game 2 and Game 3 gave us face-off gate. I'm not sure if it's officially a gate or not. I'll let you guys, the journalists on site, determine that. But now that that's sort of behind us and, you know, Logan Couture sort of maybe admitted that he overreacted, would you say that he admitted he overreacted with the comments yesterday, sort of walking him back a little bit?
I don't know if that's a good question. I think he did say, one, that Crosby didn't cheat on the game-winning face-off. Two, he said, you know, all guys do it. I don't know if he overreacted. I mean, they come off losing in overtime in a game that they didn't play very well. You're probably frustrated. You're probably feeling like you let one get away. You're probably a little ticked off at what you might feel is an advantage going to Sidney Crosby. But let's be honest, that had nothing to do with why they lost Game 2. It had nothing to do with why they lost Game 1. And that's something that Couture said yesterday. He said, like, it's a small part of the game. And, you know, when you add Sidney Crosby's name to anything, it's going to blow up and become a big story. But it was not why, you know, they're down 2-0. And I think you can point to their offense and you can point to their trouble, you know, handling the Penguins' speed. So I think it kind of blew over a little bit yesterday.
Jonas, I thought you had a really good article in the Canadian Press yesterday talking about how Pens head coach Mike Sullivan has unlocked the potential of the Pittsburgh Penguins. Certainly, as far as offense goes, if you look at the stats for goals for with the Pittsburgh Penguins, it's a goal more per game after Mike Sullivan took over from Mike Johnson. Do you think it's maybe simple, but the right thing to say that Mike Sullivan has outcoached Pete DeBoer in the first two games here?
That's hard to say. I mean, you can look at the Sharks' performance through two games and say not much went right. You know, they didn't generate much at all offensively. We didn't see the team that we saw in the Western Conference Final, who kind of blew out St. Louis for the most part. You know, that size and strength and skill of the Sharks forwards, you know, where they're able to kind of just cycle pucks, especially that top line with Pavelski, Thornton, and Hurdle. We haven't seen that turn into chances offensively. So to say he's outcoached them, I don't know. That's hard to say. I think if you look at, you know, what Sullivan has done since he took over from Mike Johnson, like you said, it's crazy, you know, when you look at the numbers, just how much of an impact he's had. Like, we can look at coaches and we kind of wonder sometimes, you know, what impact, what effect they can have, but the numbers are just so clear. You know, they're scoring more, they're possessing the puck more, they're shooting teams. And, you know, Sullivan spoke to trying to play to the Penguins' strengths, you know, to the strengths of their best players, and that's by playing fast. And if you want to look at the first couple games, you can see that the Penguins' speed has been an issue for San Jose. So to that point, you know, the effect of Mike Sullivan has been clear through the first couple games.
Jonas, you know, usually when you talk about a team up 2-0, you talk about all what they've done right, and they've done a lot of things right, but do you think Evgeny Malkin can be better, and if so, what's the key to him improving his production?
Yeah, I don't think we've seen a consistent, you know, every night where Evgeny Malkin is just dominant. There have been flashes. I think I remember in Game 1, you know, where a few shifts where he was just everywhere, and he uses his size, and he uses his skill, and he uses his strength. And Mike Sullivan was asked before the series, you know, about Evgeny Malkin and about whether the fact that he thought more was to come from Malkin based on the way the playoffs had gone to that point. And he said, of course, you know, he thinks that Malkin is just getting better and better. Obviously, you know, he had that injury late in the season that knocked him out for a bit of the playoffs. Coming back, catching up to speed is not always an easy thing, especially at postseason speeds. But I think what we've seen through the first couple games and throughout the playoffs is because the Penguins are so deep offensively, it hasn't mattered much, you know, and it presents so much of a challenge for Pete DeBoer as to matching up. Like, that Malkin line with Kunitz and Rust has been their third line. You know, they throw out the Kessel line with Bonino and Hagelin before they do Malkin. It just creates such a challenge for DeBoer as far as matchups. Now, maybe on home ice, he can maybe get a better handle on it, but you're still going to have to use your top defensive pair, you know, with Marc-Edward Vlasic against Crosby. And then it's a question of whether they can contain Kessel in that line, which has been so good.
Jonas Siegel of the Canadian Press joins us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking about the Sharks-Penguins series. Game 3 goes later on tonight in San Jose. And Jonas, the old cliche is, of course, speed kills. But are you surprised at how the Sharks haven't really been able to counteract the speed that the Penguins have been throwing at them through the first two games?
Yeah, very surprised. Like, we have it's look at the way the first couple games have gone, and it's weird because you look at the first two games, and they're really close. You know, San Jose could have won game one. You know, Nick Bonino gets that goal late in regulation to put the Penguins ahead, and then you look at game two, San Jose again doesn't play very well. They don't start great. You know, they go more than 11 minutes in the second period without getting a shot, and yet they have a chance to win it at the end of the game. They tie it late in the game, and then, you know, obviously they have an opportunity in overtime and don't end up winning. So if I'm San Jose, that's somewhat encouraging that they've been in both games and haven't played their best. And they really feel like they've gotten better from game one to game two, and they hope that that trend continues. But I'm very surprised. But saying that, all it takes is one game tonight. You know, if San Jose can come on, hold home ice, win tonight, suddenly the series is interesting again. You know, and obviously I'd expect to see a different response from San Jose. They haven't started either of the first two games very well. Maybe, you know, this being the first Stanley Cup final game ever in San Jose, maybe there's an excitement, maybe there's a rush in the building, which we saw with Pittsburgh in game one. But I'm expecting something better, but I'm definitely surprised with the way the first couple games have gone.
Jonas, you're in San Jose right now. You're in the Bay Area. What's the atmosphere like around the SAP Center? What's it like on the street? San Jose's never hosted a Stanley Cup final home game before. They've waited 25 years for this.
Yeah, well, it's weird right now for a few reasons. One, it's really early in San Jose. You know, walking to the rink this morning, it was deserted, and I was trying to find like signs of people maybe being excited about everything. Two, there's been a lot going on here.
Are the Trump supporters still there?
They are not, but that was the thing. You know, when we got in the other day, it was all about the Trump rally. And then, you know, it was the NBA Finals with right. Golden State. And then, you know, there was this soccer game that the U.S. was playing. So there've been so many events going on here that it kind of feels like that, you know, the Sharks in the final are a little bit in the background right now. But maybe, you know, this afternoon, you know, it's a 5 o'clock local start. Maybe by that time the excitement will start to build. And obviously, you know, there's no NBA game tonight. That game goes tomorrow, so maybe San Jose can kind of rally around this. But I'm curious to see the reaction because I've known this building, you know, coming here a few times. It can get really loud.
Jonas, in terms of, you know, the Sharks are at home now, is there a matchup that maybe specifically Sharks forward line against Penguins defensive pairings? Is there a matchup that the Sharks are going to try to exploit to get back in the series?
That's a good question. I think it's more the other way. You know, I would think, you know, watching the first couple games, San Jose wants to get, as I understand it, you know, Marc-Edward Vlasic and Justin Braun against Sidney Crosby as much as they can. And when you're on the road those first couple games, you don't always have that choice, you know, and we saw a lot of times, you know, where the matchup didn't work, you know, and it didn't work out, I think, as much as Pete DeBoer would have liked. So now at home, You set the matchup. You can get that matchup if you want it. Maybe, you know, that's the cure to potentially slowing down Crosby, who's been terrific. He's probably been, I don't think it's a stretch to say, the best player in the series so far. Mm-hmm. So maybe that helps San Jose a little bit. But again, you know, how do you stop Kessel? You know, how do you stop that line with Bonino and Hagelin? And then, you know, we go back to Malkin. So suddenly, even if you're able to slow down Crosby, Hornquist, and Sheary, you still have so many other lines to defend. It's a challenge, you know, and we'll see if that top line for San Jose can maybe take advantage of, you know, last change and maybe get some favorable matchups, because, you know, the possession numbers for that line have been good through the first two games, but they're not really turning that possession into chances. Like, they're cycling pucks in the offensive zone, but it's not really amounting to much. So maybe that changes now on home ice.
Jonas, you mentioned Kessel, and you covered Phil Kessel in Toronto for a number of years. What's different about Phil Kessel, if anything, with you covering him here in the Stanley Cup Final playing for Pittsburgh?
I think that he is exactly the same. Like, nothing really. To me, like you said, watching him for a bunch of years in Toronto and then seeing him here, he's the same. Like, he seems the same. I just think it took him probably a little bit of time to get acclimated to playing for a new team, to living in a new city. Like, that's a big change for any person, you know, when you've been in one place for so long, mm-hmm. played for one organization for so long, and then are playing with completely different teammates. You know, you saw in the beginning of the year, you know, they tried him with Crosby, they tried him with Malkin, and then, you know, eventually, second half, they found a fit with Nick Bonino and Carl Hagelin. And I think by that point, you know, he had become acclimated, he had become, you know, found his fit. And, you know, Mike Sullivan said that he's tried to urge Kessel to be a more complete player. That is nothing new. Every coach, you know, who's had Phil Kessel has been pushing that. But I think what we've seen from Kessel throughout his career is when the playoffs start and he's engaged every shift, he's dangerous. You know, you can even go back to that one series in Toronto when, you know, they were playing Boston. He was terrific in the seven-game series. Like, he was dynamic. He was creating opportunities. He looked much like he has so far in these playoffs. So I don't know that much has changed with Kessel. I think he's the same guy. I think he's the same player. I just think he's engaged all the time in the playoffs.
Jonas, we'll let you go on this last question. We know that Thomas Hertl didn't really skate with the team yesterday. He skated, but he was in a track suit. Obviously, they haven't hit the ice yet for the morning skate. Are you expecting that he's still going to be in the lineup, or is it really a true sort of game-time decision for the Sharks and head coach Pete DeBoer?
It's probably, I don't know, you're trying to decipher, you know, Pete DeBoer's minimal comments about it. He said, you know, Thomas Hertl has a little something, you know, he didn't seem to suggest that it was too serious, but obviously anytime a guy can't practice after a day off, you know, that raises some questions. So we'll see if he's able to get on the ice here for the optional skate at 9:30 local time. And if he can't play, you know, Melko Karlsson will move up to play with Pavelski and Thornton. He's played there before. So they do have an option. And then obviously Dana Subers, I believe, would go back in the lineup on their fourth line. So we'll see, you know, but losing Hertl would be a blow because, you know, he's quietly a pretty good player. And I think he's had a pretty good couple first games so far.
Jonas Siegel is in San Jose. He's the national hockey writer for the Canadian Press. Game 3 of the Sharks and the Penguins goes later on tonight. Jonas, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Okay, thanks, boys.
Talk to you soon. Let's head to break. When we come back, Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province joins us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Twenty minutes after the top of the hour, you're listening to TSN 1290. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Analysts Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg are with me in studio. Producer Rory behind the board. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the province, Ed Willis. Ed, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning, guys. How are you? How's everybody doing in the peg?
We're doing very well, thank you. We still miss you here. It's been a few years, but we still miss you.
I was always big in Winnipeg.
Yeah, exactly. Ed, we obviously brought you on to talk about the Vancouver Canucks, and last week they made what I guess was a bit of a controversial trade, acquiring Eric Gudbrandsson from the Florida Panthers. Jared McCann goes to Florida, of course, draft picks involved and everything else. Now that you're sort of out of the eye of the storm, and maybe the fog has lifted a little bit. What's the reaction a little bit later on to the Gudbrandsson-McCann trade?
Yeah, well, actually, my reaction hasn't really changed that much. I thought it was a good deal for the Canucks when it was made, and I still think it was a good deal. Now, the really interesting thing about this trade is this is going to be one of the first proving grounds for the great analytics versus eye test debate, which is taking place in the game. So, you know, the backdrop of this is Florida changed its management team. It's now much more analytically based. They determined Gudbrandsson was never going to be worth the money he was going to demand because of, you know, his analytical stat line. So they went ahead and made the trade. And I would submit this isn't going to be the first one made of this kind. So it's going to bear watching over the years.
Ed, do you think with the trade of Eric Gudbrandsson to Vancouver, that means that there's pretty much no chance that the Vancouver Canucks are going to bring back Dan Hamhuis?
Yeah, that's kind of the other shoe we're waiting to drop here. I mean, they're transitioning to a younger team. Yeah, I guess it depends at what cost. You know, Dan's a BC guy. He made it clear he would sign for less here. I can see a role for him as kind of that Yoda wise old head on the blue line. But they've also got a clear playing time for a kid named Nikita Tramp, and 6'7", 250-pounder, who they brought over from the KHL midway through last season and showed well. It's an interesting one. I just think the way this team is going, I'm not sure if there's a place for Hamhuis or a place for Alex Burrows for that matter, but I can also devise a scenario where they both come back at a reduced price.
Ed, when you look at back to Gudbrandsson, is he somebody who's going to slot in, say, on the second pairing behind Chris Tanev, beside Ben Hutton?
Yeah. It looks like the pairing right now are going to be Alex Edler and Chris Tanev on the number one pairing, and then Gudbrandsson and Ben Hutton on the other one. And, you know, that kind of makes sense. But, again, this deal makes all the sense in the world for the Canucks if you believe Gudbrandsson is the top four defenseman. And whatever else he is, he's 6'5", 220 pounds. He has a mean streak, and he was considered captain's material in Florida. I am unfamiliar with a game in which that player is not useful. So as this thing unravels, and, you know, as we go forward, that really is the overriding question for the Canucks. Because if they got that top four guy, and he's only 24 years old, I think they paid a modest price to get him.
What do you think, Ed, of Jared McCann? Like, what do you think he'll turn into?
Yeah, I think he will be a good support level player. I think he'll be a 20 to 25 goal guy, a 50 point guy. Don't see him as the number one center. I wonder if he's your number two center, how good a team you're going to be. Mm-hmm. He's got plus offensive instincts and tools, terrific shot, terrific release. So he will score goals. On the other hand, you know, he's a bit of a tweener. He's 6 foot, 190 pounds. He doesn't have his man's NHL body yet. So, mm-hmm. You know, that remains to be seen. So, but that's what I see him at projected. I think that's the opinion of most people around the game.
Ed Willis is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He covers the Vancouver Canucks for the Vancouver Province. Ed, the Canucks, you know, before the McCann trade, they also traded Hunter Shinkaruk, another former first-round pick, to the Calgary Flames. That happened earlier in the season. You know, are they clearing house from the former regime's draft picks and moving forward? Is there sort of a, you know, is it an indictment of the previous regime?
Yeah, I mean, you could form that conclusion. There's too much evidence of them. You know, they gave Hutton every chance to succeed, and he was a Mike Gillis draft pick. Mm-hmm. But you know, Bo Horvat is considered a building block. So they just made the determination Shinkaruk was never going to be that top six forward he was thought to be when he was going to be drafted. Is that an indictment of the previous organization? Maybe a little bit. I think the larger issue for the Canucks is, and I think where it really shows up if you follow this team, is they barely drafted a player that made their team for about 4 years in the early years of the Gillis administration. And what they've been trying to do is build up that base of players between the ages of 21 to 24. And now you look at their lineup, and they've got Svenbergi, they've got Goodbranson, they've got Granlund. So they've really done. I believe they've done a good job of buttressing that age group, that demographic, you know, in their early 20s to go along with the Horvat, with the Huttons, and whoever they draft this year. So I think that's more the issue with the previous regime than their draft picks.
Ed, you wrote about this earlier in the week for the Vancouver Province, the fact that the Vancouver Canucks have over $13 million in cap space with only Svenbergi, as you just mentioned, and Emerson Edom left to be signed. Of all of the potential targets for Jim Benning and Trevor Linden, you hear Kyle Okposo, Andrew Ladd, Milan Lucic, maybe Mikael Boedker. Which one of those forwards do you think would be the best fit for the Canucks?
Well, who I think would be the best fit would be Boedker, because he's younger, he's speed, he's fast, he's kind of a, you know, he's kind of this new age NHL type forward. I think the really interesting question is Milan Lucic, because he has a history with Jim Benning that goes back to Boston. They made a play for him last offseason when he was traded from Boston to LA. They just didn't have the assets to make it work. So he's a Vancouver kid. He's got some charisma. He'll be a draw in this market. So he ticks a lot of boxes. He's also 28, and you just wonder where he's going to fit in the new NHL. So that's a really, really interesting one for me. I bet my last dollar they're going to come away with one of those elite free agent forwards. The question is, which one?
You know, Ed, you look at the draft, and Jim Benning is pretty forthright. He says, at least he said last week or so, there's two forwards and one defenseman that the team is looking at seriously. Yep. With that pick. Where do you think they go with that?
I think it depends on what happens in front of them. I still think the Dubois kid from the Quebec League, he's a size and skill forward who projects as a centerman. I don't think based on what Matthew Tkachuk did in the Memorial Cup, he falls beyond four. So that leaves them with Dubois or Ulevi, the Finnish defenseman who played with the London Knights, who projects as a top pairing defenseman. Maybe not at the same level of player as Dubois, and that kind of creates a trade down scenario. But that's the way I see it. That's the way I see it shaking out, at least now. If Matthew Tkachuk falls to them at five, I think they would cheerfully take him because he seems to be an elite offensive player. Does maybe not as electric as Puljujarvi or Patrick Laine, but a dependable, much like his dad, I think a guy who will probably could pencil in for 30, 35 goals and 70 to 75, maybe 80 points in a good year.
Ed Willis is our guest. He covers the Vancouver Canucks for the Vancouver Province. You know, Ed, ever since Jim Benning came over as general manager, he'd of course been with the Boston organization for a number of years. Generally speaking, there seems like there's a bit of a honeymoon period when a new GM comes to take over a team. It doesn't seem like that ever really existed for Benning in Vancouver. Why is that?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure why. I think that year under John Tortorella really poisoned the water for him. I think there is kind of a suspicion of all the Canucks moves, and I think they have done a really poor job of delivering the message they want to, of packaging the message in the right way, because they've kind of flip-flopped back and forth between this we're rebuilding and we're retooling and we're doing this, and there's been all kinds of mixed messages about that. So I don't think fans have a clear idea of what it is they want, what it is they're trying to do here. But again, I look at the assets they've accumulated at the young players, and I look at his first four draft picks. And when you consider that was Jake Virtanen, Jared McCann, Thatcher Demko, who is probably the number one goaltending prospect in the game, and Triamkin, those are his first four picks. That's pretty solid work. I really believe as this thing takes hold, I think a lot of the critics will tend to evaporate. But you're bang on. Right now, there is a suspicion about them, and he isn't getting the benefit of the doubt in this market.
You know, on that point, and last question for you, Ed, Trevor Linden, does Jim Benning have his full support?
Oh, yeah, totally. Absolutely. Now, the big question is, do they have the support of ownership? And okay. I think the head coach, Willie Desjardins, I think he is the card by which that will be determined. There is some thought that ownership was pushing for Desjardins to be fired last year, and they have proven to be nothing if not impatient over the years. Mm-hmm. Trevor went to the wall for him. Willie's good for the first half of this season, but if they're struggling in 10th, 11th place, I don't see him long for this world. There's a real issue with ownership here. They are perceived to be meddling. They are perceived to be impulsive. They are perceived to make decisions that they're clearly not qualified to make. So I think that's the larger issue with this Canucks team, and I think that's the real drama that will play out this season.
Okay, one more final question. Are you coming in for the Heritage Classic?
Oh, I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to. Believe me, I am invested in Winnipeg as a hockey market, and that would be a great touchstone for me, especially because I covered pretty well all the guys who are going to be in the old timer games. So, I'd love to do that.
Well, Ed, if you do come into town, we'll definitely take you out for a beer.
Okay, well, you're on. I've been known to have one.
As all good people do. Ed Willis of the Vancouver Province, thanks very much for joining us to talk about the Canucks. Hopefully we'll see you in October for the Heritage Classic.
Cheers, guys.
Take care, Ed. It's head to break. When we come back, we discuss the NHL and Olympic participation. Minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thanks to Ed Willis, who just joined us, and before that, Jonas Siegel and Arthur Staple. In case you missed any of the program or any of those interviews, they're available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Subscribe, get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Still to come, Keener from Keener Jerseys is going to join us next segment to talk about the new Florida Panthers jerseys, as well as the concept of jersey advertisements on the jerseys at the World Cup of Hockey. Richard,
I wanted to give a quick shout out, Drew, to Steve Russell at 204 Property Restoration Services. He gave me a hand about a week and a half ago. Great guy, huge hockey fan.
Yeah,
very good hockey player. I've been told, and specializes in property loss and restoration. So give him a call if that's the field you're looking at.
There you go. Steve doing some good work for Richie, and I'll piggyback on that one. A bit of a sadder note. Anybody who followed me on social media this week or last week really saw that I was helping some relatives out in search for a lost puppy. It didn't end the way we would have liked it to have ended, but you know, we can take some solace in the fact that there were so many people who were supportive in the efforts to try and find this puppy, and I appreciate all the efforts from everybody else out there in the community who is retweeting or sharing or saying they kept an eye out for this puppy. So I do thank you for that, and I know that my cousins, who were the owners of the dog, also thank you for your efforts as well. So you know, a little bit of every now and then you need a reminder that humanity is good. And so I think we got a little bit of that in the face of some unfortunateness. Anyways, the Olympics. The Olympic participation, it sounds like the NHL is unlikely to go to the Olympics in 2018 in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Is this anything that the NHL... I mean, if the NHL doesn't go to South Korea, is there any way they can go back and go to China in 2022?
They can do whatever they want. You know... The IOC isn't exactly...
on the up and up?
Yeah, on the up and up here. And the NHL, I mean, there is a value. I think the players love the Olympics, and that's a key. But money talks, right, guys? And there's a lot of risk here for owners and for the National Hockey League. And, for example, if you look at... We had Arthur Staple on earlier. I remember losing John Tavares for the Islanders a couple of years ago. I mean, that's sure. The cost of doing business. But it costs the Islanders money and a lot of different things there. So I think they can skip and go back. I just don't like, you know, the optics of it all, especially because of where you're going back to. So, I mean, I realize that the time slot is not what they want. It's not optimal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, we know Canadians will watch kind of hockey, that kind of quality hockey, whenever it is. The Sochi didn't end up being as bad as you thought because they were able to do in the morning of some of those games. I know Pyeongchang, it would be difficult to do that. I guess it'd be what's similar to Nagano in terms
it's
of
like 18 hours or something like that.
Yeah, in the middle of the night and such. But I think the players are going to put pressure on the owners, and then the owners will put pressure on the IOC. But I don't see, maybe the NHL be a little bit flexible here, but I don't see them moving and going back to incurring costs like they were before.
Well, and that's where the big issue is right now, is that the IOC says they are not going to pick up the tab for transportation and for insurance, which is about a $10 million bill. They said that the, you know, if you want your players to participate, you're responsible for paying that $10 million.
That's what I meant. So NHL is going to pay $10 million. And what's the tangible benefit they get?
The IOC would say exposure, but the NHL would probably say, in this day and age, we can do our own. We can do our own exposure that doesn't equate to the $10 million cost.
And if they weren't, you know, obviously once again here, but I'm just going to say, if they didn't put together that joke of a tournament with the World Cup with a bunch of teams that aren't really teams, I think you'd have a better idea of whether or not that would be a significant and threat to the Olympics. I think the way they've put that tournament together doesn't really give us a full picture of whether or not it'll be a threat to the Olympics.
And Richie, I think there's been a lot of talk and a lot of press regarding the NHL not looking like they're going to go to Pyongyang, South Korea, and compete in the 2018 Olympics, and how that isn't really a bad thing because the NHL and the NHLPA have said that they want the World Cup of Hockey to be a regular event every 4 years. But the problem is, the World Cup of Hockey, as Rich mentioned, isn't really a best-on-best event.
Right.
The Olympics, to me, is still the ultimate showcase, and the winner of the Olympics is the real ultimate country, the best country. And I think, I personally believe there's 100% chance. It'll happen. They're going to the Olympics.
Really?
I think this is all posturing. I think we went down this road before Sochi, Russia, if you remember. The NHL didn't officially announce that they were going to Sochi, Russia, I think, until 4 or 5 months before the Olympics or something like that. I think they're going. And I realize that the NHL doesn't make any money off of this. But there are other ways the NHL can make money. We've talked about it before. I think, to Richie's point, the players, the NHLPA, are going to put a lot of pressure. And as far as the injuries concerns go, are there not injury concerns with the World Cup of Hockey? What if somebody gets injured at the World Cup of Hockey?
But they make money off the World Cup of Hockey.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that argument that the injury issue is one of the major issues, I think, is
the risk reward, though, right? I mean, that's from their perspective.
Yeah.
Risk reward.
Well, I mean,
can players get injured at the World Hockey Championship? The NHL doesn't make money off of that.
Yeah, and that's a valid point that you make. Absolutely. And I think from the no argument from the World Cup,
that's,
I think
that absolutely, as he makes a great point there.
Yeah, you know, it's selfish. I mean, it's selfishness on the owner's part, and I understand it. You know, you want to make they're businessmen. Why should we inconvenience our fans? Why should we inconvenience our teams? Why should we inconvenience our players?
It lengthens the season.
Yeah.
It tightens up the schedule, meaning they play more often. That probably increases the risk of injury.
Well,
it goes longer. February is a time where football's not on TV.
Yeah.
So you could sell more tickets and stuff like that.
No
baseball yet.
A 2014 study by University of Massachusetts professor Neil Longley revealed that NHL teams overloaded with Olympians suffered a significant drop in performance after the games.
Right, and I don't disagree with that, but ask anybody that was on the gold medal winning Canadian team if they regret going. Ask Drew Doughty if he regrets going. He won the Stanley Cup that year.
The players don't regret it.
You need a best on best. The World Championships isn't best on best. World Cup, this next upcoming one, is not best on best. If they don't go to the Olympics, is the hockey not going to have a best on best tournament from 2014 till 2020?
Seems
that
like
is terrible. Huh. That's a big problem.
It's something that no other sport would have. I mean, you know, and that's certainly a problem. And then, do you have a best on best every 2 years? Because it sounds like the World Cup's not going away. So are you okay with doing, you know, let's say they go to Pyeongchang in 2018.
It's Pyeongchang, right?
Yeah.
Jesse, did you say Pyongyang? I think that's North Korea.
I might have.
So 2018, let's say they go
to North Korea for the Olympics.
As he's getting sent to North Korea is what's happening. 2018, let's say they go to South Korea. Are you okay with them coming back 2 years later and doing another World Cup of Hockey best on best? Are you okay with best on best every 2 years?
I am fine with that. I mean, that's what soccer does for Europe, Euro, yes, and World Cup. Okay? I'm fine with that. But I think the World Cup needs to be different than the Olympics, and that's why I've said before I like a little more of a tournament style and maybe best of three, semi, and best of five final kind of thing. Cut down the number of teams would be a possibility.
You're talking about for the World Cup of
Hockey. Yeah, play just meaningless round-robin games for seeding. Who cares? And then do these tournaments, like do series, and then over the same span. Make it a little bit different, but just as competitive.
And I'm in the camp, Rich, that believes that if the NHL decides that it isn't going to go to the 2018 Olympics, that they should bring back the Canadian national team or allow certain players to go to the Olympics that choose to go. But I don't see that happening. If you remember 1994,
sure,
the Canadian national team with Peter Nedved and I believe Corey Hirsch was on that team, guys like that. I think you should replace that if it looks like the NHL isn't going to go,
right,
because I do feel that it is important. If you devalue the importance of winning a gold medal at the Olympics, then to Richie's point, all you really have are the World Under 20 Championships, the World Hockey Championships, but Hockey Canada doesn't place the same importance on that. Sure, we win gold, but the Olympics is a different level.
The only other sport of the big four, I guess, in North America that really has a best on best that people care about, the NBA, I mean, basketball Olympics, okay, maybe. Football obviously doesn't have it.
Yeah.
Baseball, the World Cup isn't taken seriously there. So if you want to kind of play it to soccer, then you want to have best on best as often as possible. I think that's what fans want.
Well, to your point, Izzy, about the Canadian national team coming back into the picture, I mean, the way it works for soccer in the Olympics is that it's an under-23 model.
You can't take some of the team's best players in the middle of the season and not shut down the league.
I'm not saying that they would come necessarily from the NHL, but maybe you restrict it to players that are either AHL players or I guess they'd have to be
AHL
players.
What about
AHL
how much players. Money the World Junior Championships makes?
Yeah. I mean, there's no ideal, there's no surefire solution aside from doing a best, going to the Olympics every 4 years and doing World Cup of Hockey on the years in between.
Why should the IOC not cover that bill?
The IOC should cover that bill from my perspective. $10 million for the IOC, this is their bribe money. Each of these IOC members has that under their mattresses because that's what they've been paid off to go to Rio and to go to all these other terrible cities that they're going to. I mean, come on. I mean, the IOC is just a bunch of crooks. Probably getting sued for that comment, but that's a separate issue altogether now.
No, I think you're probably pretty right on that one.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Florida Panthers' new jerseys. Keener Jerseys joins us to break down what the Panthers have done. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. One final segment still to come here on TSN 1290. I might just do you in. Ain't it a sin?
Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
One final segment this Saturday morning here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg with you. The segment is brought to you by Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys is known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want an awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want personalized, visit Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com. The Florida Panthers just unveiled a new uniform, a new jersey, so we are pleased to be joined by Keener himself.
Hey.
To talk about the Florida Panthers' new jersey. Keener, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Our pleasure. So the Panthers come out. It's got the new Panther itself is a little less ferocious than maybe the old Panther that we're used to, and they want to go about the respect and the classic and, a very sort of traditional style. What were your initial thoughts about the new Florida Panthers uniform?
Well, first of all, I thought the crest looked a lot like a car logo, against a Jaguar or something. Sure. But and red and gold, that's cool. Like that's, I haven't seen that before in the NHL. I think that's a 49ers kind of colors. Maybe there's a little darker red, but I don't know. I thought it was weird the way they presented this, though. Like, this is, the finals are going on right now. This is Penguins and Sharks' time to shine, and then the Panthers come out going like, hey, remember us? We got new jerseys.
Keeter, when you think about the old Florida Panthers jerseys, it's obviously the end of an era, the Leaping Cat. Which specific player, which jersey do you think of when you think of that old Panthers jersey?
Probably Van Beesbrouck and his run to the final in that jersey. I think that was their second year in the league.
Something like that, yeah. Back in, was that 90?
Third or fourth year, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Number 34.
Yeah, yeah, and his big gold Panther helmet.
What do you think, Keener? The numbers on the shoulders you're seeing a little bit more often now. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the Oilers did that with their orange jersey. I guess it's like back when they expanded, like the Oakland Seals did something similar like that. But and then they put that patch below it. So I don't know. They're causing all kinds of crazy stuff now with uniforms. Like they've really changed the game.
Well, Keener Jersey joins us to talk about the Florida Panthers' new jersey. Keener, and one of the things that the Panthers have done is that in addition to having a C or an A, sort of like we're accustomed to on every NHL team, you know, in the sort of the top of the top of the corner, they've actually put the word captain or alternate on the side, on the sleeve of the jersey itself. Is that something you could see becoming, you know, a fad in the NHL, or you know, how do you feel about the actual word being spelled out for those players who do earn the captain or alternate captain designations in Florida?
Well, I didn't know they were doing that. That just blew my mind. like I saw the Red Wings did something like that with their Winter Classic. They put the C and A's on the sleeve in a diamond shape, but spelling the whole word out—that's I don't even know. I'm in shock right now.
Keener, getting away from the Florida Panthers jerseys for a second and getting on the topic of advertisements on jerseys, I know we've talked to you about this before. The Philadelphia 76ers have become the first of the four major professional sports franchises to announce that they're going to put the advertising on jerseys. When you talk about advertising on jerseys, it seems like a foregone conclusion. For you, is it something that you're prepared for, and is it just a matter of if they do it the proper way?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm like, I just hope that if it happens, that the fans come together and protest and make the teams feel it. Because I don't like it. I don't want advertisements on jerseys. And I know if it happens, it's probably, we just have to suck it up and this is how it's going now. And, but yeah, like, it'd be nice if people would just stop buying jerseys, I guess. I shouldn't say that. I own a jersey company. But like that's the only way they would stop it from happening if they try it, and then they'd be like, well, this obviously doesn't work. Like if the Habs jersey has a McDonald's logo on it and people stop going to McDonald's, then they'll probably say, well, this is having the opposite effect. But I can't really see that happening. And if it happens, then it looks like we just have to, yeah, just live with it.
Keener, one of the features of the Panthers' new jersey, it's got a sort of a thick horizontal stripe. Right in the center of the body, sort of reminiscent of the Montreal Canadiens home jersey. You know, what do you think about teams sort of copying some of the most classic jerseys in sports? Like, say, you know, if a team sort of went with a pinstripes like the Yankees, or, you know, this big stripe, which is, you know, you immediately think Montreal Canadiens. What are your opinions of a team like Florida that certainly doesn't have the pedigree of the Montreal Canadiens sort of trying to piggyback on that?
Yeah, I can see what they're doing, and at first I was thinking exactly like, well, that's Montreal, but I guess the stripe's a bit wider, it's a different color. They're wearing red, too. Like, it's kind of like maybe if you were Navy or something, it wouldn't have been so reminiscent of the Canadians. But, yeah, I guess like it's just like any other art. You have to take your influences from past things you've liked. It's too bad Montreal is still wearing it. It would have been nice if they brought back something kind of like those shoulder numbers from the past that nobody, everyone's like, oh, right, like the big V. Like if they did something like that, like Vancouver did back in the 80s, like that flying V jersey. But I guess you can't because there's no V in Florida Panthers.
Keeter, we haven't had you on in, I think, 2 or 3 months now, and you guys have actually moved locations, leaving Osborne Village for 982 Portage Avenue. How's the location looking now?
It's great. There's tons of room. Nothing's really set up yet. Signs haven't even arrived. But, yeah, we've got production going. Everyone's selling like it ain't no thing. And pretty soon, yeah, we're going to have a showroom set up and with some jerseys on display of like that you can get for teams or like even like the customized pro jerseys. Just, yeah, it's going to be great. We got a big Ken Dryden. We hauled him over. Big statue, life-size Ken Dryden. He's worth the trip himself.
Well, there you have it, the Keener Jersey's new location on Portage Avenue. Keener, really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us to discuss the new Florida Panthers jerseys.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Our pleasure, Keener. There's Keener of Keener Jerseys. You can check him out for all your jersey needs. A couple minutes to go before we wrap up for this Saturday morning here on the show, guys. Game 3 goes tonight. I thought it's sort of humorous. You know, we had Jonas Siegel on at the top of the hour. And, you know, the San Jose Sharks, this is really their first opportunity to really get the center of attention. Very few people watch Sharks games. They're on the West Coast, you know, East Coast bias, everything else. And their luck that it happens at the same time the Golden State Warriors are likely going to win the NBA championship. Probably, I don't know if they're the greatest team in NBA history, but they're right up there in the top two or top three.
It's a must-win, Drew. I mean, they lose this game, the series is over. And I agree with you. Maybe it hasn't been getting the attention.
Mm-hmm.
They got to win this. They've waited 25 years to get here. And they've beaten the LA Kings, their arch nemesis. They've gotten through the Nashville Predators, the St. Louis Blues. They got to make a series of it here because Pittsburgh in the first two games has really dominated the play.
In terms of the way they stand in that area and the attention that they're getting, well, you can make your own headlines. You win games and make it a series and make it exciting. If you go out and lose in 4 or 5 games, then you're not going to get the headlines, and too bad.
Sure. I just caught a glimpse of it. I don't know the exact numbers, but the ratings are absolutely they're terrible. The TV ratings in the U.S. for this series as compared to last year.
The Canadian ratings weren't bad, though, I don't believe.
I didn't see the Canadian ratings, so I can't speak
about
to that.
This morning. They're okay, I think.
Well, I mean, then that the Canadian ratings, they can be thankful for. It's Sidney Crosby is the only one. He moves the dial still. The superstar moves the dial, and it'll be interesting to see Crosby, you know, won the faceoff, you know, called the play, called a shot.
It's been excellent
in game two. And you know, somebody said, I think I saw it online, that the way he's playing, and you mentioned it, Rich, yourself, you know, Thornton was trying to sort of get under his skin, and Crosby's got that singular focus.
It looked like Kobe when Chris Rock was trash-talking him or talking and beaking his ear, if you remember that in the finals. Was that against Boston, I think? Kobe Bryant was sitting there and so focused, and I know it's obviously a Hollywood star versus a Joe Thornton going at you, but Crosby looked to be that focused.
Yeah. Well, I think it does change. I mean, if you're a two-time cup winner,
100%.
It changes it from 100%. Being a one-time cup winner.
100%.
And so Sidney Crosby with that singular focus, we'll see what happens tonight in Game 3 between the Sharks and the Penguins.
Remember when Drew asked us if he was done mid-season?
Yeah. Hey, I'm also the guy.
You picked Pittsburgh, I know.
I picked Pittsburgh at the beginning of the year, Richard. That's it for this Saturday in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, the Riverview Health Center Foundation, Cycle on Life, less than 24 hours to still donate to Team Illegal Curve, Keener Jerseys, and the Bell Acres Clear Lake Golf Course. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. For producer Rory, for Richard Pollock, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Thanks for joining us. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290.
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show.